Hey folks, great to have you back. My name is Peter Lehrman. I'm the host of the Masters in Small Business M&A podcast. Today, I am really excited to sit down with Kelsey Lyric, CEO of 365 Holdings. Kelsey, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So like we just said offline, we're both just starting to wade into podcasting, both as guests and as hosts. And so we'll just have a very personal conversation about 365 Holdings, about you, about the deals that you're doing in the e-commerce category. I'm really excited to dive in. I think the best place to start is just to hear a little bit about you and the intersection of you and the origin of 365 Holdings. So just take us through how you ultimately got to the point in time where you started 365 Holdings and how it came to be.
Sure. So 365 is myself and my business partner, Justin, as the founders. And our story really starts probably 5 or 6 years before 365 proper or any of our e-commerce endeavors. Justin and I met and started buying incredibly small businesses, really calling them a business is a bit generous, but we both were self-employed early in life and hit it off and just had a series of locally run service-oriented businesses. And we finally had a very small exit that provided enough liquidity to be the down payment on an SBA loan for the first e-commerce business that we bought. Within 90 days of buying that e-commerce business, we maxed out the line of credit and took all the cash and bought our second one. And shortly thereafter, we started 365 Holdings LLC, like the proper holdco entity, and structured it. Justin and I have always had a great relationship where I was a sales and marketing and ideas guy. He was kind of the operations execution guy. I think we always knew directionally we wanted to have a business of some scale or some substance. If you'd asked me 5 or 6 years ago if it'd be e-commerce, I wouldn't have had an opinion on that. I would not have predicted e-commerce to be where we would build a company in. But through a lot of hard work and some good luck and some good people, e-commerce is where we find ourselves today. And that's our real passion is building the holdco, working with our team. The brands that we've acquired are awesome brands, but our real passion is really running 365 as an organization. And it really harkens back to him and I just kind of grinding it out for years as true, like honest to God, small business operators, and now scaling into a much more meaningful organization through leverage, some risk taking, and plowing retained earnings back into things every year.
I love it. So before we get to 365 and what you've done with it in the last handful of years, what were the small businesses just from a category perspective that you all were running in? And also, how did you guys originally meet?
Yeah, I'll try to make this the really short version of the long story. We met at a networking group. If you've ever been to a coffee shop and seen like the realtor and the banker and the local painter and handyman meeting for coffee for an hour, there's a whole category of organizations that charge money to show up and like trade leads. So Justin and I met at one of those events. We ended up buying the local franchise of that company together as our first business. I think it was a couple $1,000s from each of us to get in there. I probably had to borrow my money from my dad. I think he took it out on a line of credit on his house. But we bought a networking group. Over the years, we bought the timekeeping company that sold time clocks and software. We bought a small piece of software that did specialized kind of reporting for financial advisors. We had a check processing company. And we had a business that took down satellite dishes. If you want your DirecTV dish gone, they don't do it for you. We had a network of contractors nationwide that would come take that off your house for a small fee. And so just like truly a diverse array of very simple businesses that provided a service. And again, no real scale. It was always the two of us, maybe some contract help, but no office, no team to speak of, and just a small business hustle for a number of years until we finally had accumulated enough to go out and try to do a meaningful acquisition. The first business we bought was like a $1 million purchase price with an SBA loan. And that's like a pivotal moment was building up to that.
So the businesses that you guys were buying prior to 365 Holdings, formally the formal inception of 365, were those all businesses that were locally based in Ohio? I know you're Ohio based, or were they elsewhere?
All but one was, no, that's not true. We would operate them here locally. We're both in Northeast Ohio. We're both married and have kids. This is home for us. But they were businesses that didn't have an office or a team or a geographical constraint. So we operate them from coffee shops and home offices and wherever we want to.
Got it. Okay. Tell me about how you stumbled your way into e-commerce, because I actually didn't realize that. I thought the origin story was going to be Well, I was doing all of this great work for a bunch of e-commerce business owners, and I was helping them make a bunch of money, and I was doing all the work, and they were grabbing all of the retained earnings. And I just decided to go into the business myself. So I've heard that story about e-commerce operators, but tell me, how did you arrive at e-commerce and how did you ultimately decide to make it one of the defining aspects of 365?
When I realized we'd have the liquidity to buy a business of substantial scale instead of businesses that required us to own or operate them, I just started looking at things that I thought we would be suited for that ranged from services, which had been our background, to software, which I never could wrap my arms around, the asking prices, to e-commerce. And the first deal was a really conservative valuation, a motivated seller, and we were just comfortable with our ability to be able to run that business. And frankly, it was a good price.
But that doesn't mean that you then go all the way in on DTC brands exclusively. So at some point, you made the decision to really be very specific to that category. When did that happen?
It probably took a year to divest the other businesses that we've been operating and to begin building the view of what 365 could eventually turn into. I did not have an articulate, well-defined strike zone or vision for the business or strike zone for the deals and the kind of acquisition criteria that we have today. In the rearview mirror, it's going to look much more put together now than I had the foresight to engineer.
So 365 Holdings was from day one largely organized around the e-commerce thesis. And today it has, if I'm not mistaken, you own 6 businesses through the 365 Holdings holding company. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's hear a little bit about the 6 businesses that you've bought in terms of just the kinds of e-commerce businesses that they are. Like, how do you define the strike zone now as you look out the front of the car as opposed to the rearview mirror? Like, what kinds of businesses are you looking for? And how do the 6 that you've already bought demonstrate that and represent that?
I recently had to do a bunch of work on getting better at explaining this, and we'll have some forthcoming updates to our website and kind of company branding, because it's been an evolution and it's taken me some time to be able to put this into some succinct words. So it's a great topic. If you look back at the history of like consumer spending, it really starts in America, like post-World War II. And the landscape was dominated by a very small number of humongous brands. And they'd advertise on billboards and radio and ABC and NBC and CBS. You fast forward 50 years and the internet changes everything. And now we have the opportunity for lots and lots and lots of much smaller companies that advertise on Facebook and Google and TikTok and Amazon. And kind of the democratization of consumer spending has happened on the backs of Shopify and performance marketing on the internet. And I believe that there are going to be thousands of what I call micro brands. A micro brand is a company that makes a product that is branded. And when I say the name of the product category, you say, oh, I buy that product category from this brand. And it's easy to think of big names in D2C that make news headlines, but there are thousands of small companies that people are passionate about that you and I have never heard of that will have an enduringly profitable business model because they have raving fans. And that business will never hit scale to be bought by a strategic buyer or to go public. That business needs a permanent home. And the vision for 365 now is to accumulate these micro brands. They're going to do $5 million or $10 or $15 million in revenue, maybe 20 or 30 on the high end, but they're profitable. They're going to grow slow and steady. They have a great product, a loyal following, and they need to exist. They deserve to exist. They're great companies, but they themselves probably can't hit escape velocity and platform scale. So 365 is the platform that operates those businesses. I view our business as operating 365 Holdings. The brands that we own and the channels we sell on are just profit centers for our operating business. We're not a holding company in the sense of Berkshire, where everybody that runs those businesses for Mr. Buffett sends their checks back to HQ every so often. We truly operate our businesses. We're vertically integrated, and we want to just be a home for these great micro brands. And again, I truly believe that in the future, there will be thousands and thousands of small profitable businesses that are doing $5 to $30 million in revenue that just need a permanent home for operations and capital. And that's what we're seeking to be.
That's perfect. That's really well said. So do you have a good understanding of why the internet was such a big unlock for the development of these small brands? If your sort of thesis is right and post-World War II, everything was dominated by huge companies, and the internet is the primary unlocking mechanism for a much longer tail of consumer product brands to arrive. Like, what drives that? What has the internet or any other things done to create a dynamic where there can be a much longer tail of consumer brands that can be sustainable, as opposed to a huge amount of dominance by a small number now consolidate on the internet, as opposed to consolidating in the pre-internet? What's the unlock that's changed the economics in an enduring way?
I think it's the ability for a niche long tail business to have economics that are sustainable. So I'll give you just one example. We own a business about a year ago called Cultures for Health. We make fermentation supplies. If you are a DIY person at home and you want to make kombucha or sourdough bread or yogurt or milk kefir, we sell you everything you need to get started. If we look back to like pre-internet scale, you'd have to go buy those products at a grocery store. There's literally only so much shelf space, even at a natural foods grocery store, to stock products in that particular segment. Short of building, I don't know, a mail order catalog business and somehow building a brand that way, I can't perceive of a way in which the catalog that we sell today of fermentation kits and fermentation cultures, I don't know how that would exist if I couldn't reach people on the internet. I can't understand what would have to happen for a consumer to be aware of the product category, interested to look for it, able to order it, pay for it, have it show up. Like, I can't fathom what the circumstances would be that would allow that business to even exist, let alone scale. So I think it's niche, enthusiast, long tail segments that people care about, people love, people want a brand affinity for and have a demand for. And a Facebook ad can unlock it. Amazon can surface it in a search result. Shopify lets us sell it fast and easy. Like, the technology just enables these niches to exist in a long tail.
And so does that tend to boil down to just a fundamental change in customer acquisition cost for the brands? Or does it show up elsewhere in the P&L?
It's even just distribution. So like, back to Cultures for Health, like, we have a few products and a few natural grocers, but your main market grocery store, your Sam's Club or Walmart or Kroger, they can't stock an enthusiast product to make your own fermented food. They don't have the shelf space for it. The unit economics don't work for them.
And so how do you distribute?
The unit economics do work for us on the internet.
So how is that product getting distributed?
We are selling 85% of our revenue is D2C. We take the order on our website and we ship it from our warehouse. We do a little bit of business on Amazon. We do a little bit of business in wholesale. But from a holdco perspective, we're 85% D2C. So people Google us. People are referred to us. People see our Facebook ads. They're on our email list and they're buying from us directly. And we're pick, packing, and shipping it from our own warehouse.
Okay, got it.
And that applies whether you are a specialty brand of socks for runners, whether you are fermented foods like a business that we own, whether you're a men's hair care product. You can insert any unique requirement or any niche enthusiast community. And there are more people that want to access it than local retailers that can fill the need on a profitable basis.
So let's talk quickly about deals. Roughly how many transactions have you done, call it, in the last, I guess, 2 to 3 years here?
Let's call it 7 or 8, give or take. We've only sold one along the way, so it should be 7.
Got it. Okay. Let's just cover some basics on just how are you structuring transactions typically for these kinds of businesses? Just take me through the nuts and bolts of pricing, valuation, and how you tend to finance the acquisitions.
So we're fundamentally buying small businesses. We're going to underwrite those in a relatively conservative manner based on history. So we're looking for cash flow metrics that drive our valuation. And we're looking for a lot of history to think it's a sustainable business model that when the ecosystem changes and ad costs change and consumer preferences shift and time goes on, that we think there's actually a moat around the business and it's a real going concern asset. Once we've come to that, we're typically paying 3 to 5 times earnings. And that's going to include a reasonable amount of working capital in that valuation. We've done everything from paying cash to putting down very little and leveraging heavily with SBA to earnouts. Like, we've done really, I think, every transaction structure you could conceive of. We've bought distressed assets that we had just had a real conviction for that kind of didn't fit our profitable underwriting model of, you know, here's our cash flow and here's the multiple we're paying. But we've just bought businesses based on our ability to operate that business and really on a pro forma financial model. with a very low entry cost that we thought was a reasonable risk for us to take. So it's been a kind of a wide range.
Do you find yourself converging on a preferred structure, or do you continue to be open and flexible to a novel set of transaction structures for every transaction, or are you trying to converge more on a certain template?
As an entrepreneur, I'm interested in everything. As a leader of a going concern business, trying to build something that's itself enduring, I think we need to templatize and systematize into a much more traditional private equity style financial structure. So my own personal interests as an entrepreneur sometimes diverge from what's maybe in the best interest of the business. And right now I'm really focused on what's in the best interest of the business, which is to templatize, systematize, and build a recurring, repeatable system that the team can run with or without myself and Justin spinning the wheel anymore.
And there you're talking about the acquisition structuring process, or are you talking about post-transaction?
Definitely post-transaction, which once that is dialed in, can also lead to the team making more decisions in the acquisition process. Right now, there is no acquisition team. It's me. Do we have folks in finance? Yes. Operations, of course. But right now, the deal process is me. And as we get the operations more and more dialed in, the next thing I want to do is begin to build a decision-making process for the organization to allow M&A to scale beyond just my own efforts.
Let's talk a little bit about, because I think a lot of people think holding company and they say, oh, okay, permanent home, permanent capital of some sort, permanent buyer for businesses, small central office, and the businesses just continue to sort of operate as is, and the holdco assembles a collection of businesses. But you've created a vertically integrated holding company where effectively, if I'm not mistaken, each of the e-commerce businesses that you buy is almost like a product line of 365
Correct.
Holdings, right? So let's talk about that, because I think that's an important piece of the story. I think a lot of people just put holding companies into a single sort of definitional box. You definitely challenged that. Why did you make that decision? Why have you set it up that way?
That was always the goal, was to own and operate businesses. We don't have any outside capital. So again, the capital base for 365 is retained earnings, the bank debt that we've been fortunate enough to borrow, and sweat equity. There is no rich uncle that's funded all of this or outside gone into it yet. I'd like to keep it that way for as long as it makes sense. Maybe it was just naive of me to pick the name Holdings. As an entrepreneur, I made sense. Like, hey, I need a place for the things that we own and operate. I need a holding company. I don't have an investment banking pedigree to say, oh, well, that's not really what a holding company is. A holding company is this passive vehicle. I never had that conversation in my head. I needed email address and a website that gave me credibility with brokers that said, hey, we own more than one business. We are not brand new. I didn't know what a search fund was at the time. We would probably be thrown into like the self-funded searcher category today, I suppose. I just needed a name. I think I spent all 5 minutes on the list of ideas and my brother-in-law did the logo for $10 in his spare time. I wish it was more thought out and intentional as a better story for you, but.
Well, no, I think the interesting story is the fact that as you guys scale, you continue to bet and rebet on a process where you're buying companies and then you're actively operating them as P&Ls and product lines where you're scaling up at the holding company level, a set of teams and a set of capabilities that can really go in and actually be part of the future, inflect the curve for those businesses post-transaction. So I think that's actually the interesting story, less whether you're called 365 Holdings or something else. So one of the things that I'd mentioned just in the outline of topics was if you had to pick sort of one area where you think 365 today has become very competent and very capable post-transaction in terms of really improving how a business is operated after it's bought by 365 Holdings, where do you, if you had to concentrate your bets in one of the areas, I'm sure you're doing a variety of things or aspire to do a variety of things, but where do you feel like you're the best right now in terms of changing the inflection of a business after you've acquired it?
Two parts to that answer. Part number one is inch deep, mile wide. We've seen so many things that in each one of our businesses that we have a bit of an advantage of the typical outgoing founder or owner usually has a list of things like, oh, I've always thought about X or Y or Z. I was never very good at this. Never got around to that. Chances are we've touched those topics, whether it's performance advertising on Google and Facebook, whether it's inventory management and forecasting, whether it's email marketing and retention, like whatever the topic is. We at least have experience with it. Maybe we're not best in class in it. Maybe we think we are. But like, we have covered all those things. So I think we have a competitive advantage in how we view kind of operational excellence and that list of coulda, shoulda, wouldas for most small businesses, even mid-sized businesses. We've seen a lot. So I think that's part of the answer. Part two is we just developed a brand management team. And I think one of the ongoing struggles that we've had, as I've talked to others in and around the space that are multi-brand operators in e-commerce, whatever flavor that they may be, there's always this capital allocation problem of not only financial capital, but human resources and time and effort of where do I concentrate time? Where do I invest? And building out a brand management process where an algorithm decides the business strategy, our competitive positioning, the amount of resources and time we pour into new product development, potentially even the acquisition process gets driven by this team at some point. But building that into a process instead of me and Justin as entrepreneurs having to make those decisions, having that be a core competency of the organization is a big priority for me this year. And I think long-term, that will be the true answer, is that we have a process by which we can understand the markets that we're in and drive better internal capital allocation based on our unique position of view of the market and our experience in running that team.
For example, with the at-home ingredients business, for folks that want to produce their own kombucha or other sort of at-home sort of DIY products, it's called Cultures of Health, or isn't that what it's called?
Cultures for Health, yep.
Cultures for Health, yeah. So how long have you held that business at this point?
Just over a year.
Okay. So like in the case of that business, what do you think is the biggest change that's happened to that business in the year that you've held it? How does that business start 2022 most different from the way that it looked when you closed the transaction about a year ago?
Relocating it from North Carolina to Ohio. That's also big. Relocating a couple of its team members that decided to join us. Moving it to our ERP, building out its facility, and trying to get it integrated into 365. I don't know that we materially improved that business, but we did integrate that business. And now we have a foundation to begin working on those improvements.
And so how much of your team is in a transaction like that? I mean, how much of your full-time team that's operating at 365 Holdings becomes committed to that business? Is there a team that's essentially dispatched on an indefinite basis, or are your teams splitting their time across the different businesses that are executing different P&Ls post-integration?
Yes, we really work on functional areas. So if you're in marketing, you work in marketing. If you are the email person, you do emails for all of our brands. If you are the Google Ads person, you do Google Ads for all of our brands. Very much a shared services approach. Maybe one thing that'd be helpful to note is historically, the businesses we've bought for one reason or another, this is relatively common in e-commerce actually, unlike, say, a metal stamping company. The assumption for every transaction we've been in, except for Colors Craft, was that the buyer would not have the team that was currently running the business post-closing. For one reason or another, whether it was staffed by agents, geography, there's a myriad of reasons. A lot of e-com businesses change hands with a minimal team in place or the expectation of virtually no team sometimes. Cultures for Health was the first business we bought where we inherited a good chunk of a team post-closing. We made the decision relatively quickly after close that made a lot of sense to relocate and integrate that business and not run it in a different geo. So we had to work through severances and doing right by the team that I didn't want to relocate. But that was kind of the first time we've actually dealt with that, because historically, every other business was built to be packed up, relocated, and then operated by us when it landed here in Ohio.
Okay, got it. I'm going to switch gears, I guess, a little bit, because I was looking through your Twitter feed, which we'll make sure to plug before we wrap up. But I was looking through your Twitter feed. Sounds like you introduced an EIR program not too long ago. I remember seeing that tweet myself and just really raising an eyebrow at that. I've seen the EIR programs in a whole bunch of other contexts. I've seen them in particular in the venture capital world. You have some guy who had a great run at a company. The company was sold or went public, and they sort of set up a way station for that operator inside of a venture capital firm to go and take a look at existing portfolio companies and stuff like that. And then off they go into sort of their next chapter. Tell me about the EIR program that you're building, why you built it, and how does it work? In the quick summary on Twitter, it sounds one of the elements of it was potentially investing in the business. So I'd love to hear about everything top to bottom on this and just how it connects to the idea of a holding company that owns all of its companies versus investing.
Probably goes back to the comment I made earlier about my own entrepreneurial aspirations versus the need to systematize and mature and professionalize the business as an operating company. I think the EIR program is a great example of that first bucket of like entrepreneurial interests. So both Justin and I as founders and entrepreneurs have a real soft spot for people that want to own their own business one day. We've seen a streak amongst some of our users that they have a side business or an entrepreneurial goal one day, just wanted to find ways to and integrate that into our culture. I think if I were to unpack what I wrote in the original version of our EIR program, was really incubator for potential talent to be able to change our business model one day when it makes sense. So today we're this very vertically integrated one team running six businesses. I don't know how long it will make sense to do that scale, it necessarily holds in every aspect. I do think that we're going to have a lot of high quality people that go through the organization that want to own their own business one day. And if you build a great relationship with the founders and you leave to go run a company, whether it's one that I want to underwrite and buy and sponsor and finance, or one that you want to go out and search for and acquire yourself, part of your basis of your relationship with the organization is that the founder is backing you when you go and do something else. I really put that out into the world just to see what would come, what conversations it would spur. There are certainly others that have a more professionalized, formalized process for that. That's really just to get people to ask me about it. It's really just to get people to contact me and to see what happens through time. I'm currently working on a version 2 of restructuring that with Vitality. I learned some things over the past year of having that out into the ether, having people ask me about it and having conversations about it. And I think that we'll make some improvements and tighten up the process for what that looks like going forward. Because to start, it was very open-ended and it was meant to me learn and experience what level of interest and what type of people responded to that message.
Where would you like to see it go based upon all the conversations you've had on it since then?
I think that whether it's capital strategy for the holding company or just part of the entrepreneurial career for Justin and I, at some point I'll want to invest in things that we don't us or just generally a way to diversify our balance sheet.
So with the EIR program, sounds like it was almost like an experimental approach. You put it out there and you got a bunch of feedback. You've learned a bunch of things. Where would you like to see it go from here? Now that you've had a bunch of conversations, spoken with a bunch of people about it, what would you like to see happen?
I think the real end goal is to find people that can and should and will operate businesses and will be a president, CEO person, whether that job title, that really matters. But I think when I look at the aspirations that Justin and I have, the holding company will continue to grow with its shared services, vertically integrated model. But whether it's for our own balance sheet as a holding company or for just our own aspirations individually, Justin and I, the ability to mentor, invest in, partner with kind of the next generation of entrepreneurs. Frankly, I wish somebody maybe had done that for us. It might have been a faster journey if we had help and guidance along the way, if I had found myself a decade ago. And exactly know every nook and cranny of what that will look like. But I do learnings from putting into the ether as an experiment really just dialed in the fact I want to figure out. And I'm looking forward to what that looks like in the future.
Yeah. So if you were to invest in an EIR's business, would that be an investment, a capital investment out of 365 Holdings?
Serial decision at this point. Again, like the holdco is myself and Justin. So if the two of us want to make a financial decision for ourselves, whether one checkbook or the other, is probably not that today. I do think big picture, having a strategy that looks like at scale might matter. But to your point earlier, it's not a passive vehicle, the holding company. It is an operating business, has its own balance sheet and its own growth goals, operating these six profit centers. This is just meant to be kind of the early innings of figuring out what happens after that.
Well, it sounds really kind of interesting. I mean, I haven't seen any of that anywhere else. I hope you stick with it.
There are more professionalized search fund incubators, kind of running a classic search fund model with some economics around training and sponsorship. And I don't know that this was designed to compete with that business model. Mm-hmm. I do think that our business today of vertical integration and running one operating business might change in the future, and having great people that we can partner with when that happens makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I see the overlap with search fund platforms. I think minimally what you might be cooking up is, because it's so focused on e-commerce, or presumably so focused, I think that's minimally one place where it differs. Most of the search fund platforms, if I'm not mistaken, are backing a large number of entrepreneurs that are pursuing relatively agnostic businesses from an industry perspective. And so a lot of their expertise is more grounded in deal sourcing and lists and, you know, outbound, as opposed to having real expertise on a very specific way to operate a business post-transaction in e-commerce or some other end market or specific industry. Anyway.
I've had a strong thesis for a while, an independent sponsor model for trends too small for private equity and too big for an individual buyer. And I could see this being the talent pool that eventually gets utilized to go execute those businesses. They'd be, you know, too big for 365 to vertically integrate, or it wouldn't make sense to, for any number of reasons, integrate it in the way we have traditionally. But if it does make sense to sponsor that transaction, whether we use our balance sheet or not, having a stable of people we could put in place in leadership there will give us a really strong competitive advantage in adding that business model to what we do here.
Well, I read your annual letter. When did you publish that?
I don't remember the exact date, but I think it was just before the end of the year.
Okay. So what I really liked about it, I know there's a number of folks that are beginning to publish annual letters and share them in public more publicly. What I really liked about it minimally was it was super readable. It was nice and concise. And you did a little bit of forecasting and just called out something that I think is minimally interesting, might be a bit of a contrarian point of view. I'm just going to quickly read this from your annual letter. I think that the writing is on the wall that in 2022, we will see news of big changes across the spectrum for multi-brand e-commerce organizations. Some of the big FBA aggregators will either blow up or get sold. And some of the smaller DTC-focused holding companies will announce meaningful changes in structure or strategy. So what has you saying that? I mean, that was clearly something specific that you have in your mind's eye about what could happen. Talk us through what you're envisioning could happen and why you decided to include that as something for 2022 as a possibility. I know it's crystal ball, but tell us what you're thinking there.
I think the headline on that section was, I don't make the letter to be annual predictions. That's not a goal of mine, but this topic felt so important. It would be like the elephant in the room if I didn't address it. Can't meet somebody or go to a conference and not have them immediately lump us into this aggregator category, which I think was really popularized for organizations focused on acquiring Amazon sellers. So this entire industry of businesses that just sell on Amazon.com or 90% plus on Amazon.com, and roll up funds such as Thrasio and Perch and some others have raised a lot of venture money to aggregate those businesses with the goal of the EBITDA arbitrage, buying them for 3 to 5 times and going public at 20 times or whatever the case might be. It makes sense on paper. I think operationally, as an operator of a small business that sells things on the internet, I know how challenging that is. I know what the problems are that we have. And I feel like between supply chain issues, inflation, the headwinds on Amazon.com specifically with third-party sellers from overseas and some of the black hat practices that happen, it just feels like a lot of pressure. And if you miss a quarter and your balance sheet goes sideways and you have inventory problems, I could just see how easy it could be to blow up one of those models when you miss some milestones between rounds. From talking with people I'd consider to be peers, people running e-commerce businesses, two or more of them, whether they're formerly a holdco or just somebody that at least two different brands, but selling, you know, $5 to $50 million of product, not having venture scale backing. And I talk to these people and I think about the challenges we have as an organization. I ask them what they're working on. I do feel like there's been a lot of people building up portfolios of brands, ourselves included, that it's only been a few years of people doing this with any amount of meaningful scale. And I think a lot of people are going to make decisions on changes in structure, changes in strategy. We've been pretty vocal about vertical integration. We're focused on an in-office full-time team. Other people have different strategies. They were going to use outsourcers and contractors and work remotely. They're going to buy different types of businesses than we're going to buy. I just feel like there's going to be a number of organizations that either publicly or quietly just make a lot of changes. It was a rough year for e-commerce last year between digital advertising and privacy changes, supply chain, shipping costs are going up. There's just a lot of things that I think will mean that some people are going to decide to change their business model.
Is there a way in which a lot of the businesses are being bought by the aggregators in terms of how they're structuring the deals that you think makes them particularly vulnerable? In other words, is the transaction structure a place that's creating risk, or is it just the operational challenges and the more fundamental business model and EBITDA arbitrage that is puzzling to you?
I think it's the latter. Many people at those organizations are a lot smarter and more successful. And so I could be very much that they'll all have fantastic outcomes for themselves and hope with their investors as well. I see all the pressure. My partner and I, we had a conversation this year about the Ben Horowitz, read the hard thing about hard things, what his take on wartime is, and kind of the idea of a wartime CEO versus a peacetime CEO. Mm-hmm. It really felt like wartime last year with everything as external pressure, staffing shortage, to COVID, to just all of it. And I look at the amount of effort it takes us to do what we do with six businesses. I don't understand the scale that has to happen to do that for 60 or 100 or 200 of them. It just feels like a very complicated operation.
So do you feel like that if you were to practice what you preach there, do you envision a limit on the number of businesses that you would want to at any point own and operate at 365 Holdings?
Yeah, I do. Part of that brand team process that we talked about earlier is going to be mapping our competitive positioning for market share and for how attractive the different market segments are that we're in. And developing a thesis, if we want to be the permanent home, when does it make sense for us not to be the permanent home? What are the criteria to decide to divest of a business and to go shopping in some other category? And to build a process around that. I don't think that we can be as good of an organization with 30 businesses as we can with six. I don't know how many we have to buy and sell to find the six we want to own forever or what things will happen along the way. But I do intuitively think that we will do some selling through, even though our intention is to buy and hold things. There are things that aren't going to work out. There's a portfolio approach where you have some real outsized outcomes, and identifying those, investing in those, and building a culture in the organization to embrace that, I think will help make us successful through time because it'll make it less emotional and it'll make it more process driven.
You divested the businesses that you were owning and operating prior to 365 Holdings, or you still hold those in a different vehicle? What's the status of all the businesses that you and Justin ran prior to 365?
They were all either sold or wound down.
And how did you sell them?
That's a great question. I think a couple of them I put on biz buy sell. I think one we just turned off and closed. And I think brokered one of them, but they were definitely small businesses and I operating them, and we weren't going to invest in our being distracted by this little business over here that does 5% of the revenue as the e-commerce businesses. It wouldn't have made sense.
Right. Maybe last thing to cover from the annual letter, which had some good nuggets in it. One of the things that you mentioned towards the tail end of it is that you're looking forward to finding a new financing partner to fuel your growth as part of the 2022 business plan. Tell us what you mean by that.
So we have funded the business, like I said earlier, with retained earnings and SBA loans. And we've made heavy use of kind of some of the tech working capital lenders. So that's leveraging our merchant accounts, leveraging our inventory. And that's been fantastic. It's allowed Justin and I not to sell any equity in the business, to kind of go to our four values we have for the organization. The first one of the four is team and culture first, and being able to make decisions with our organization's best interest in mind and not having to hit certain goals for financial sponsor from private equity or venture capital has been important to us as we figure out our own entrepreneurial path. We turned a corner with financial maturity around the EBITDA size, around our accounting processes, history, tax returns that I feel like we're now able to graduate from SBA lending to lower middle market lending and get an actual cash flow bank that will look business instead of my credit score and Justin's credit score in our houses and bank the business. So that's a goal for mine this year, is to execute a refinancing, hopefully with a partner that is interested in funding acquisitions and organic growth beyond the refinance, but to do it in a conservative debt leveraged way that lets us continue to execute on our acquisition process and not jeopardize kind of that first value of the fact that Justin and I maintain kind of that relationship with our team, that they're not going to worry about outside pressure from an investor.
Sure. So
Nothing wrong with that model. It's just very important to us.
Sure. Yeah. So the target there is a debt-centric or debt-only financing partner and nothing at the equity level, at least not yet.
If I found a transaction that we wanted to do that was going to involve a seller rolling over a meaningful amount of equity or needing to raise capital, it would not be a 365 Holdings deal. It might be a 365, it might be a transaction that Kelly invest in and that we want to sponsor. It would not end up being a part of this operating business.
Right. Well, this has been great.
I was going to insert a joke if there was a lender listening that wanted to underwrite our upcoming financing to contact me.
Oh, there may be. We'll see. It's worth putting out there, just like the EIR program, right? Yeah. Justin and you, are you guys both points of contact related to that, or is it just
me? So kind of our relationship is I get to do fun things like go on podcasts and talk about the future of our company and understand strategy should be. Mm-hmm. And Justin makes sure that we execute on the day-to-day. So unless it has to do with project management and supply chain and hiring and firing and growing the team and kind of those operational responsibilities, that's going to fall in my lap. If it does require something operational, I probably won't know the answer. So it's got to go to him. Kind of a running joke that I don't even have logins to some of that stuff anymore to know the answer. But yeah, financing would be a Kelsey topic.
Kelsey, it's been great to sit down with you for about an hour here and hear about what you've built with Justin and the team that's behind you. Huge congratulations on what you've achieved. Really exciting to continue to watch it develop from here. I hope you guys continue to have great success. It's really exciting to hear about. Thank you for taking some time to share the story of 365 Holdings and love to have you back on maybe in a little while when you've turned the crank on a couple levels across the business. We can catch up on some of your forecasts too.
I appreciate the invite and thank you for the time. And if another version of this down the road makes sense, we'd be happy to do it.
Kelsey, where would you like people to either follow along or reach out to you about something specific?
Yeah, I'm active on Twitter. You can certainly find me on LinkedIn. 365-holdings.com is the website. There's a contact form on there if you need to reach me. Also, we have a newsletter that is not very much, but if you want updates from the company, such as our annual letters, you can opt into the email list on 365-holdings.com.
All right, Kelsey. Thanks a ton. Enjoyed this.
Thanks, Peter.